From WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, December 20th. Republicans want to honor Donald Trump with a presidential library in Florida without interference from local government. Central Florida State Senator Jason Brodeur filed a bill that prohibits any county, local, or even state entity from enforcing their regulations on such libraries. If it becomes law, Trump would have to follow federal regulations, but otherwise could do as he wants if he chooses to build his library in the state. Brodeur said Trump, quote, has built the most beautiful buildings and properties on planet Earth, unquote. The state senator also said that, quote, it was time for America's Phoenix to have his library done as he envisions it, without input from a county or city government, unquote. After gathering input from 1,500 residents, the city of Sarasota presented plans for a Main Street facelift all the way from School Avenue in the east to the bayfront in the west. The idea is to morph the city's main drag into a street that equally accommodates cars, buses, bicyclists, and pedestrians. The top five priorities from community input are outdoor spaces, more shade, more lighting, space for outdoor dining, and attractive landscaping. City planners want to accommodate that by widening sidewalks and reducing parking spaces on one side of the street, converting angled parking to parallel parking. Reducing parking goes against the desires of business owners, but the public input suggests parking at a distance will not be a deterrent. The facelift will also include special materials for sidewalks and hardscapes, trees and other plantings, as well as lighting and other amenities. Growing faster than almost any other state, Florida's estimated population topped 23.3 million this year. That's according to data released Thursday by the U.S. Census Bureau. Florida's increase of close to 470,000 people this year was second only to Texas, and Florida's 2% growth rate trailed only that of the District of Columbia. The population growth was fueled by international migration, which accounted for 84% of the rising numbers. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, December 20th.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Tis the season to wish everyone happy holidays. I wonder when the Orange Menace of Palm Beach and now Washington, D.C. will begin to claim that he saved Christmas as if it had ever been lost by insisting the only suitable holiday greeting was Merry Christmas. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my interview with North Saunders, Executive Director of Safe Communities Coalition, a bipartisan group opposing the anti-vaccine agenda in state houses, who will discuss the potential danger to the health of the country if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is tapped to head Health and Human Services. But first, hear how Democrats are preparing for tougher court battles to oppose illegal policies instituted by the new administration than the first time around. Democratic-led states that have vowed to challenge President-elect Donald Trump's initiatives will face a tough legal landscape after his first term appointments reshape the judiciary, not only giving the U.S. Supreme Court a conservative supermajority, but also diluting liberal judges' influence on key appeals courts that often stymied his agenda. During the Republicans' first term, Democratic state attorneys general brought 155 multi-state lawsuits against his policies, notching an 85% success rate, according to a database maintained by Marquette University political scientist Paul Nolet. California, Washington, and other Western states led the charge then and are preparing to do so again. The 23 states that will have Democratic attorneys general next year are reviewing Trump's campaign promises and laying the groundwork for legal challenges on issues such as immigration, the environment, and health care. We've thought about the legal arguments. California Attorney General Rob Bontas told a Democrat told Reuters, "We in many cases have briefs ready to file. Just got to cross the T's and dot the I's and press print." As for comment on potential litigation, Trump transition team spokeswoman Carolyn Leavitt in a statement said Trump will serve all Americans, even those who did not vote for him, and will unify the country through success. Bonta cited Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants in the United States illegally as a potential litigation target for California, home to more than 10 million immigrants. The California Department of Justice, which Bonta heads, would receive much of the $25 million in funding Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom requested this month for legal fights with the Trump administration. But the lawsuits will proceed through federal judiciary remade by Trump during his first 4 years in office by his near-record 234 judicial appointments, representing about a quarter of all judges, including three U.S. Supreme Court justices, that gave it a 6-3 conservative supermajority. Trump's Supreme Court appointees have moved it dramatically rightward, issuing rulings that have overturned the nationwide right to abortion, expanded gun rights, and limited the authority of government regulators. But the high court hears only a handful of cases each year. Before a case can reach the justices, it must wind its way through lower courts, including federal appeals courts that often have the final say. Trump transformed those appeals courts as well, appointing 54 appellate judges. He flipped 19 seats previously held by Democratic appointees on interim court in intermediate courts after Senate Republicans opted to cease allowing senators to block appellate court nominees from their home state they did not support. Key among the appeals courts during Trump's first term was the San Francisco-based 9th U.S. Circuit of Court of Appeals, long considered the most liberal of the 12 regional appeals courts. Many cases challenging Trump's policies in the first administration ended up at the Ninth Circuit after being initially filed in the Northern District of California, whose 14 active judges in San Francisco, San Jose, and Oakland are all Democratic appointees and frequently issued injunctions at the request of Trump's opponents. The Ninth Circuit is expected to again play host to litigation challenging Trump's agenda. Bonta declined to telegraph or signal our strategy, but he said he believed that the vast majority of the courts will provide us a fair hearing and will prevail. Trump in 2018 described the Ninth Circuit as a disgrace, as it had issued a series of decisions rejecting key parts of his first term agenda, including against his travel ban from six Muslim majority countries and his bid to rescind the Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals Program, otherwise known as DACA, that protects immigrants brought into the country illegally as children from deportation. But Trump, in the meantime, gained the chance to name 10 conservative judges to the Ninth Circuit, which, when he took office in 2017, had 18 Democratic appointees, 7 Republican appointees, and 4 vacancies. President Trump transformed the once-out-of-whack liberal Ninth Circuit, said Mike Davis, a Trump ally in the advocacy group of the Article III Project. Today, it has 16 Democratic appointees and 13 named by Republican presidents, a shift that has increased the frequency of conservatives dominating the randomly drawn panels that hear appeals in the court. There's more to risk in going there. John Collins, a law professor at George Washington University, said of the Ninth Circuit, it's less of a sure thing. Confidence in the judicial system has reached a record low, according to a recent poll. Americans' confidence in the nation's courts and judicial systems have plummeted 24 percentage points in the past 4 years, sagging to a record low per a new Gallup poll. Not only does the decline make the U.S. an outlier among other wealthy nations, but it is one of the steepest drops Gallup has measured globally on this metric. The nine countries or territories with larger percentage drops in judicial system confidence over a four-year period include Myanmar, overlapping military rule, Venezuela, deep economic and political turmoil, and Civil War era Syria. 35% of respondents said that they have confidence in the U.S. judicial system and courts per the Gallup poll. That's a drop from 42% last year. Confidence in the courts has dropped for both those who approve and disapprove of U.S. leadership under President Biden. 2024 also marks the first time that confidence in the courts has been below 50% among both those who approve and those who disapprove of U.S. leadership. Only 44% of those who approve of U.S. leadership under Biden expressed confidence in the judicial system and courts in 2024. This year is the first year on record that confidence in the judicial system among those who approve of U.S. leadership has dipped below 60%. Sentiment among this group remained steady between 2021 and 2023 before dropping this year. While it's not abnormal for those who disapprove of their country's leadership to lose confidence in the judiciary over time, according to Gallup, the significant drop under Biden signals that something profound occurred. It's likely, Gallup notes, that President-elect Trump's web of legal cases, which is consistently railed against as politically motivated, was a notable factor. Similarly, the decline for those who approve of U.S. leadership could be tied to the disapproval of some Supreme Court and lower court rulings that went in Trump's favor, per Gallup. Americans' confidence in the court lags far behind that of peers in other wealthy nations. Between 2006 and 2020, Americans' perceptions of the courts often fell in line with the median of countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a forum of 37 democracies with market-based economies. This year, the OECD median settled at 55%, expressing confidence in courts. The decline in judicial confidence in the U.S. has left the largest gap, 20 points, between Americans and the median of OECD nations since the Gallup poll began in 2006. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Apparently, a pair of Supreme Court justices contradict themselves in rulings. Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas have again tipped their hands and shown that their ideology guides their Supreme Court just judgments more than legal philosophy, according to a report. The conservative jurists issued conflicting decisions last week in a pair of cases involving parental rights and gender identity, offering contradictory analyses that Slate columnist Hila Kiran said reveal a position of parental rights for me, but not for thee. If our Constitution protects parents' autonomy regarding their children's upbringing, how can the protection apply only to parents who oppose responsiveness to gender identity issues, wrote Kiran, a professor at Southwestern Law School. And if Alito and Thomas are so convinced that courts should hear those parents, why do they sound so eager to allow Tennessee to override parents' support of their children's gender identity? Karen was referring to the decisions, including one regarding a case called Parent Protecting Our Children versus Eau Claire Area School District. The pair ruled that a petition by conservative parents against the Wisconsin school district offering to support students experiencing gender identity issues should have been granted. But in an earlier ruling this month, U.S. versus Scarametti, no concern for parental rights was shown by the two justices when they considered a Tennessee ban on gender-affirming care for children. The concept of parents of children who will suffer because of termination of their care was brushed aside, Karen wrote. Karen argued that Alito failed to show even minimal commitment to consistency and impartiality in his decisions on the two cases, although she was heartened by the other conservatives, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, refused to consider the premature concerns of parents of children who had not suffered any harm, and she was confused by Brett Kavanaugh's position on the cases. His willingness to hear conservative parents in Eau Claire matches his interest in Tennessee's response in Scarametti to the argument that the state should have deferred to the parents on medical issues, Karen wrote. He was also careful not to join Alito and Thomas's call to federal judges to delve into difficult constitutional questions, which aligns with his comments in Scarametti that the policy debates might be better left to the democratic process. Time will tell if Kavanaugh will show consistency and support granting the still pending petition of parents in Scarametti or any forthcoming similar petitions that Barrett explicitly invited during oral arguments. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has notified the incoming administration about the obvious conflict of interest the first buddy Elon Musk presents. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, wrote a letter to President-elect Donald Trump this week to request clear and transparent conflict of interest rules that would bind Elon Musk, the world's richest man, during his role as a Trump advisor. The letter sent by email from the Democrat Senate office to Trump's transition team notes that regular members of the Trump-Vance 2025 transition team operate under an ethics policy that requires them to both avoid actual and apparent conflicts of interest. These rules, which have been published by the General Services Administration, include prohibition from transition team members working on particular matters involving specific parties to affect their interests. Musk, who is worth $474 billion, according to the Bloomberg Billionaire Index, spent more than $250 million to help elect Trump president and has since embraced the label First Buddy to describe his role. He has been a frequent presence at Trump's side, advising the government formation and taking a lead role in a new effort to cut federal spending. It's not clear what ethics rule, if any, Musk has agreed to follow in his role as a Trump advisor. Putting Mr. Musk in a position to influence billions of dollars of government contracts and regulatory enforcement without a stringent conflict of interest agreement in place is an invitation for corruption on a scale not seen in our lifetimes, Warren wrote. As your transition team ethics plan makes clear, the role of government is not to line the pockets of the wealthiest Americans. A strong, enforceable ethics plan for the world's richest man is a necessary first step for delivering on that promise. Caroline Levitt, a spokeswoman for the transition, did not address Musk's ethics commitments in her response to the letter. She instead addressed Warren with a derogatory nickname that Trump has used to describe Warren because of her claims to having some Native American ancestry. President Trump has assembled the most impressive and qualified team of innovators, entrepreneurs, and geniuses to advise and staff our government, Levitt said in a statement. Pocahontas can play political games and send toothless letters, but the Trump-Vance transition will continue to be held to the highest ethical and legal standards possible, a standard unfamiliar to a career politician whose societal impact is one thousandth of the 24th of Elon Musk's. During the presidential campaign, Musk became a top surrogate for Trump, holding events in Pennsylvania, making media appearances, and staging high-profile cash giveaways to encourage voters to engage. Trump promised, if elected, to accelerate federal plans to land a mission on Mars, a major priority of Trump's rocket company, SpaceX. Tesla, another company Musk runs, receives federal funding for its electric vehicle charging stations, and several of his companies have significant regulatory issues before the government. The National Highway Safety Administration is investigating Tesla for several pedestrian accidents. Musk recently posted a response to a settlement demand from the Securities and Exchange Commission for potential securities fraud. Other Musk enterprises, including the satellite internet provider Starlink and brain implant company Neuralink, have separate contracts and regulatory issues before the federal government. Federal employees are generally prohibited by law from acting on particular matters that affect their own financial interests. There are also federal conflict of interest statutes that apply to members of certain federal advisory committees. The Warren letter asked Trump team 14 questions about the rules governing Musk and his associates and others involved in the Department of Government Efficiency project that Trump has asked Musk to lead. The questions concern what ethics rules Musk has agreed to and whether he has agreed to recuse himself from any matters. Moving forward, will he recuse himself from matters affecting Tesla, SpaceX, X, or any other company he owns in which he has a substantial investment, Warren asked at one point. Currently, the American public has no way of knowing whether the advice that he is whispering to you in secret is good for the country or merely good for his own bottom line, Warren wrote. They're eating the dogs was part of the lie of the year, according to PolitiFact. Underlying 2024's most outrageous political lie was a truth. Some might even argue a confession voiced by an accomplice. To get media attention, then vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance acknowledged, "Sometimes I have to create stories." And so, with brazen disregard for facts, Donald Trump and his running mate repeatedly peddled a created story that in Springfield, Ohio, Haitian immigrants were eating pet dogs and cats. With this claim amplified before 67 million television viewers in his debate against Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Kamala Harris, Trump took his anti-immigrant, the U.S. borders out of control campaign agenda to a new level. In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, Trump said September 10th. The people that came in, they're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. This is what's happening in our country, and it's a shame. City and county officials said repeatedly that it was not happening. Rebuttals did not diminish the consequences. Dozens of bomb threats at schools, grocery stores, and government buildings, pleas from locals to leave them alone, a local lack of constructive debate on immigration and border policies. After the threats subsided, some Haitians didn't want to go public or send their children to school. The police department sent an officer to protect churchgoers at the Haitian Creole Sunday afternoon mass. Haitian restaurant owners and school children heard taunts from people using Trump's words. "Dad, do we eat dogs at the house?" Jacob Payen, a Haitian Community Alliance spokesperson and business owner, recalled his 7-year-old son asking. Vance's central role in fanning unwarranted attention on the city in a state he represents in the U.S. Senate caused resentment among some locals. "Vance threw us under the bus," said Rob Baker, a political science professor since 1987 at Springfield's Wittenberg University. PolitiFact, for which 16 years has issued a year-end lie of the year report, keenly understands that when emotions collide with facts, emotions often prevail. To wit, Trump increased his voter support in Clark County, Ohio, which includes Springfield this year, above what he garnered in his 2016 and 2020 campaigns. In choosing the 2024 lie of the year, the claims by Vance and Trump about Haitians eating pets stood out. It was an absurd statement that Trump raised unprompted on the debate stage, and neither Trump nor Vance stopped there. They stuck with the narrative for the rest of the campaign over the objections of allies who debunked it and pleaded with them to let it go. When challenged by voters and interviewers, Trump said he heard it on TV. Vance said constituents had called his office with the claim. What am I supposed to do? Hang up the phone and tell them that they're a liar because the media doesn't want me to talk about it, Vance said in Ohio. Emboldened by Vance's embrace of the rumor, Trump's debate outburst cemented lasting consequences, stigmatizing a town and its residents in the name of campaign rage. For those reasons, Trump and Vance own the 2024 Lie of the Year. Press is bracing for more attacks from the president-elect, but they're willing to fight back. News organizations are on high alert after President-elect Trump filed yet another defamation lawsuit this week and vowed to continue suing news outlets and influencers over their coverage. While there are political levers that Trump can pull to target media companies, harassment campaigns and lawsuits that drain companies of time, money, resources, and trust are often the easier and just as punitive. ABC's $15 million defamation settlement with Trump shocked some legal experts who say ABC could have easily won the case. The lawsuit stemmed from a March 2024 interview with Star ABC reporter George Stephanopoulos and Rep. Nancy Mace from South Carolina, a rape survivor. Stephanopoulos repeatedly said Trump was liable for rape when in reality, he was liable for assault and defamation. Trump sued ABC in Florida federal court shortly thereafter. ABC has declined to say why it settled, but media onlookers see the settlement as a possible effort to avoid further scrutiny and legal attacks from the president-elect ahead of his second term. Trump's victory over ABC prompted him to consider more legal action against news outlets he claims defamed him. This week, Trump filed suit against the Des Moines Register over a poll it ran showing him possibly losing the presidential race. He vowed to continue suing news outlets and influencers for defamation. It costs a lot of money to do it, but we have to straighten out the press, he said in a press conference at Mar-a-Lago. Trump has been suing media companies for years, but leading up to his second term, he's taken a more aggressive stance. Trump filed a $10 billion lawsuit against CBS over allegedly doctoring his 60 Minutes interview with Vice President. It's doctoring its 60 Minutes interview with Vice President Harris. And CBS has filed motions to dismiss the complaints. The parent company to Trump's Truth Social Network, Trump Media and Technology Group, has filed a $3.8 billion defamation lawsuit against the Post, claiming an article falsely accused the company of securities fraud. While Trump has a long history of filing lawsuits against media companies, he doesn't have a winning track record. A $475 million lawsuit against CNN was dismissed by a Florida federal court last year. New York State's Supreme Court tossed a defamation lawsuit filed by Trump's reelection campaign against the New York Times over an op-ed. Trump has also lost several key legal battles against the media over the past few years, including pulling press credentials for reporters he doesn't like, blocking people online, and deleting online posts that are considered official presidential records. Trump has been involved in thousands of lawsuits throughout his business career, but media cases began to spike significantly during his first presidential campaign, per an analysis from USA Today. In the past, Trump has threatened to open up libel laws to be able to further target the press. The federal standard for libel, established by 1964's New York Times versus Sullivan case, sets a very high bar for libel. Press freedom advocates warn that Trump's lawsuits against the press will create a significant chilling effect, forcing media companies to pull punches to avoid legal scrutiny. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Coming up next is my conversation with North Saunders, Executive Director of Safe Communities Coalition.
I am Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome North Saunders, Executive Director of Safe Community Coalition. SAFE, which stands for Science and Families Engaging. And are the only organized bipartisan political force opposing the anti-vaccine agenda in state houses across the country. Thank you for making some time for us today, North. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to talk to you about the work that we do. I don't think it's ever been more important given the political climate, both at the state and federal level.
Yeah, just give us a little bit of background about yourself and, you know, and the start of Safe Communities, you know, as well as the main chapter that I guess you also had in addition to being the executive director of the national organization.
Yeah, so I came to this work in 2019 as a grassroots political organizer. I thought that, you know, vaccines were something that the majority of Americans believed in and supported and used to keep their kids and families safe from these diseases. And I learned that in Maine, where I live, that we had the worst in the nation immunization rates for pertussis. And there were outbreaks of pertussis, which is also called whooping cough, at schools all across the state. And so our legislature looked at why Maine had low immunization rates and identified that it was the non-medical exemptions that families were using to get their kids out of being immunized. And so our legislature took up the issue and wanted to remove those non-medical exemptions for school entry requirements. And so the legislation was introduced, and I heard about it through my wife, who's a pediatrician, and she said, "You work in politics. This is an interesting intersection of our work. Would you go testify and, you know, help improve immunization rates?" And I said, "Sure." And I showed up at our state house, and there was just a large number of anti-vaccine folks that had showed up. They had obviously been there for a long time. They had strong relationships with certain lawmakers. They had unified talking points. And so I realized it was a real political fight that we needed to organize and find the advocates that cared about the issue and empower them to go and talk to their lawmakers.
Yeah, you know, before we you know move on and talk about the danger you know that we all face now, I still want to learn like just a little bit more about Safe Communities Coalition that you know currently there's I guess you know nine groups, nine states where it's organized, and two that are going to be organized soon. And you know, and you've also, you know, monitored like 400 and nearly 500, you know, bills that would affect vaccines in states. That's pretty good. I mean, what are you seeing though? I mean, in those.
Yeah. And so, you know, kind of moving on from the main issue. And so what we found in Maine was that we needed a grassroots campaign, essentially. And so we formed Maine Families for Vaccines to be that campaign. And so we had support from pediatrician groups, we had support from the medical association, the hospital association, but more importantly, we had strong grassroots support. And so we showed up to the legislature, testified, and put the pressure on the lawmakers under the banner of Maine Families for Vaccines to pass the legislation. And we were ultimately successful and remove those non-medical exemptions. The anti-vaccine forces didn't like that, and Maine has what's called a people's veto option. So anything that the legislature passes, if they go out and collect enough signatures, they can put it to a referendum. And so they did that. They collected 75,000 signatures and put it on the ballot. And so our grassroots organization quickly professionalized. We ran a statewide campaign to stop the veto, support the legislation, and ultimately won at the ballot box with 73% of Maine voters supporting strong immunization laws. And it felt like a great a great win for public health. And from that, we started to hear from people in other states. We started to hear that the movement in Maine felt different than other public health efforts, particularly because it was focused on grassroots organizing and bringing real individuals to the state house and building the relationships with lawmakers. And so, along with a couple of other allies across the country, we were able to form SAFE to help bring this work to the state houses in diverse places. And so our first foray into organizing outside of Maine was in Louisiana in 2022. And this was at the height of the pandemic backlash to COVID restrictions. And so there were 39 pieces of anti-vaccine legislation introduced in Louisiana. And so we put on our organizing hats, found advocates on the ground there, and built Louisiana Families for Vaccines around those advocates to make sure that those anti-vaccine laws did not get passed. And we were successful. There were, you know, I said 39 pieces of anti-vax legislation introduced, and we were able to defeat all 39 of them. And so Louisiana and Maine are very different states. You know, the politics are very different, but it felt like we had a model that we could replicate. And so from Maine and Louisiana, as you said, we now have 9 of these pro-vaccine Families for Vaccines chapters in states, adding 2 more to the roster right now. And really, it's about finding those advocates at the state level, empowering them with resources, but more importantly, with the skills and knowledge and talking points that it takes to go in and talk to lawmakers. And so you mentioned this last legislative session, nearly 500 pieces of legislation introduced. And I think for the most part, we've been able to kind of hold back the anti-vaccine forces, and the legislation, for the most part, did not advance. You know, there have been a couple of losses in conservative states. And I think going into the 2025 legislative session, we're pretty concerned about what we're going to see. And I think the work that we do has never been more important than ever. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a background about the work and where we've been.
And as I look at your website, yes, there were, nearly 500 in 2024, but the previous 2 years, bills, anti-vax bills proposed in state houses, but I guess in 2022 and 2023, it was like over 3,500. There was some definite backlash. But let's move on to the current situation of all the questionable cabinet secretaries proposed by the president-elect. Perhaps the one posing the most clear and present danger would be appointing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head Health and Human Services. Considering his well-known anti-vax position, what could happen if he had the power to do some of the things he's claimed are endangering as opposed to protecting the health of Americans?
Yeah, so I think about it in kind of 3 large buckets of the what could happen in 2025. And so the first up is definitely the people, and RFK chief among them, as a person who has espoused anti-vaccine rhetoric for a long time. But there's also other federal appointees that can wield a lot of power at the federal government in terms of having an impact on immunization rates. And I think there's going to be a fairly big restructuring of the agencies. And so at HHS, at the CDC, at the FDA, at the National Institutes of Health, we're going to see, brain drain is the right word, but certainly there's going to be a lot of folks who have worked for a long time in those fields, and that institutional knowledge is going to be lost. The second big bucket, and I think the impact that those appointees could start to have, is around the funding for vaccine programs. And so most vaccine programs at the state level are funded by federal dollars, and RFK and the other appointees are going to wield a lot of control over those federal dollars. The first of which are discretionary funds called 317 funds that go to fund many state immunization programs. And those are people that are actually getting shots in arms to the most at-risk populations, that's doing immunization education to providers and all the other aspects of state immunization programs. And so those funds are discretionary and can be cut immediately. We could also see funding requirements from the federal government that include riders that would say, here's the funding, but you can't talk about this vaccine or that vaccine, or you can't do education to this population, or you can't support school immunization programs. So there could be these riders that could severely limit how the funds that are coming from the federal government could be used at the state level. And then there's kind of the large federal programs, including the Vaccines for Children program, that helps immunize millions upon millions of kids across the country. And they could, the loss of that program could severely undermine the hallmark of immunization programs in the country, which are, you know, school immunization requirements. There are a bunch of other, you know, kind of ancillary issues. You know, we're not really sure what the incoming administration, and if RFK gets appointed, what they're going to look at. But the ACIP recommendations, and so that's the committee at the CDC that looks at the vaccine science and then makes recommendations for new vaccines. They reauthorize or look at immunizations for seasonal diseases like flu and COVID. And so that body will be under the control of RFK if he gets confirmed and you know, the nominee for the new CDC director, Dr. Weldon. And so that committee could just be completely hamstrung. It could be shut down. It could be filled with anti-vaccine skeptics. Or they could just choose not to meet, and that would essentially slow down all of the vaccine development and approval going into the future. And so if there are emerging diseases that we need to respond to, that body won't have the ability to respond and make recommendations.
Okay, I just want to interrupt for a second and remind listeners just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, and I'm speaking to North Sonder, who is the executive director of Safe Communities Coalition. I guess with that funding, control of the purse strings, while RFK Jr. has claimed that anybody who wants to get inoculated can. You know, it sounds to me like, if you want your child to be inoculated, it could suddenly become, like, really expensive, other things. You know?
Really expensive or just very difficult to even find immunizations.
Yeah.
And so, there are millions of American parents that want to immunize their kids with the latest COVID vaccine. And they can't find that vaccine because it's just not available in the communities that they live in. And so we're going to see the most at-risk populations become even more at risk because there's not the funding to support vaccine access. I think additionally, the CDC funds a lot of vaccine education programs. And so those are people that are building vaccine confidence across the country. Those dollars could go to other groups like Bobby Kennedy's Children's Health Defense, and they could be out there miseducating people with false information about vaccines and creating more hesitancy.
Yeah, speaking of RFK's claims, that childhood vaccines are responsible for the increase in autism. You know, that's been clearly debunked. I mean, let's go over it real quickly. What did he claim, and what is the truth?
Yeah, and so there was it all stems from a study published in The Lancet, which is a British medical journal that linked autism to the MMR vaccine. That study has been categorically debunked. It was falsified information, and there has been countless amounts of research to show that there is no link between autism and vaccines.
Yeah, right. And as clearly it was debunked, the claims are, though, and this is, I guess, the difficulty. You know, when someone, a somewhat recognizable public figure, makes unsupported claims that vaccines are unsafe, it has consequences. You know, now, it seemed like that really manifested itself at COVID when, I of course, was here like everybody else at COVID, and we all cheered when they came up with a vaccine. But it seemed like 2 weeks later, there were other people saying that the vaccine was dangerous and that you didn't want to get it. You know, didn't that politically motivated reluctance cost lives? I mean, because that's all it was. It had nothing to do with the science.
You know, I think there's like there's political motivations. There's also real financial motivations. There's a large swath of medically adjacent grifters that make money on sowing doubt about proven science and medicine. And so they sell alternative supplements. They sell alternative treatments. You know, they peddle in this misinformation. And so you have the misinformation peddlers who are gaining notoriety by peddling that misinformation and gaining an audience. And then you have people who are actually making money on selling alternative medicine that does not work. And so I think the, you know, I, for one, was very excited when there was a vaccine developed for COVID. And I think it saved a lot of lives. But I think the misinformation peddlers certainly profited by sowing doubt.
Yeah, and that's what it seemed to be, because, you know, while, you know, at the beginning of their pitch, you know, they claimed the vaccines were harmful, you know, but then, of course, that was quickly followed with, but here's another thing you can do, and you can buy it from me.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. You know, just for the record, you know, and this is, you know, sort of a broad question over the course of time, you know, and I've seen the number, you know, and I want you to say it. I mean, how many lives is it estimated have been saved by vaccines, you know, since the beginnings of them in the 20s, I guess?
Hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
So, you know, they estimate that vaccines right now save 4 to 5 million lives annually. And so if you look back over the course of vaccine development, it's hundreds of millions of lives have been saved by vaccines.
You know, and, you know, among those lives are, you know, like tons of children. I mean, I remember when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, and I'm dating myself, and I got my polio vaccine. We were all very, very excited because there were kids in my neighborhood that had contracted polio, you know. But also, too, though, you know, there's that whole basket of childhood diseases that have been, if not eradicated, really slowed because of requiring all students to be vaccinated. What's going to happen if they stop that? I mean, that used to be tied to federal funding for schools, right? They all had to get on board and everybody had to be vaccinated. Or so far they still do, right, as far as I know.
Yeah, you know, there are vaccine requirements for school entry, and you know, it's most of those childhood immunizations like polio, like measles, like chickenpox. And those diseases, if we're not at a certain threshold, and it's different for every disease, if there's not a certain amount of community immunity through immunization, then those diseases are going to run wild. And so, you know, I spoke about low immunization rates here in my home state of pertussis. And there were outbreaks of disease of pertussis, and kids were hospitalized. And I think if we see the systematic destruction of the vaccine infrastructure in this nation, these diseases are going to run wild again. Kids are going to be hospitalized. Kids are going to die. But also the most at-risk people in our population are going to suffer. You know, the immunocompromised, the elderly. And so it's not just some kids get a little sick. Like, the real implications here is that we're going to see people die. And it's tragic. It's tragic. And I get a little choked up, like, thinking about, like, who do I know that's going to be put at risk because of the misinformation and then the destruction of the vaccine infrastructure in this country?
You know, speaking, I mean, to your point about childhood vaccines, you know, people have to realize that, you know, a vaccine's efficacy, you know, requires, you know, full participation. You know, you can't have half the people get the vaccine in a certain population and the other half not and expect it to do anything, because, like, particularly with COVID, you know, you've provided a nice little laboratory for the virus to expand and mutate and just make other people sick, right? I mean, that's a basic of vaccines, right?
Exactly. So, like, you know, herd immunity matters. And, you know, by getting immunized, you're protecting yourself, but you're also protecting the person that you could possibly infect if you weren't vaccinated. And so it's a responsibility. You know, it's the reason that we have school entry requirements, the reason that we have healthcare requirements, is to help protect other people in addition to yourself. And so I think it's very selfish to get immunized, but it's also more selfish to not get immunized because you're relying on everybody else to protect you.
Exactly. You know, and that was, you know, one of the issues with, you know, COVID. And, you know, I mean, some of the people, you know, would claim that, oh, I'm not against the vaccine, I'm against the mandate. But it's like, you know, do you want this debilitating disease to go on forever or not? You know, I mean, government has the power to mandate it. And oh, yeah, how big of an inconvenience was it to go get that shot? You know, that's my question.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I, you know, I think it's easy to look at it from a selfish perspective. I think we need to take a little bit of a step back and think of that we live in civil society. We live in a society of laws, right? Like, I can drive on the left side of the road if I want to. No one's saying that I can't. But if I do, there are consequences, right? And so the reason that we have school mandates and healthcare mandates is because that's the best way to protect the most people. You know, schools are laboratories of disease. And being able to eliminate those childhood diseases that we immunize against in those settings, it really goes a long way to protect the entire society against the scourge of these vaccine-preventable diseases.
Yeah, you know, you brought it up earlier, you know, talking about, you know, how, you know, some of the grifters, you know, came out of the woodwork, you know, during the pandemic, you know, trying to propose, you know, we'll run down the actual science and, you know, and propose other solutions that only they could sell and make money on. But, you know, I think it's what's even as disturbing is that, you know, those people are obviously motivated to make money. The disturbing trend is that people just in general are, you know, don't respect discoveries or the knowledge of conventional medicine, that, you know, people that made these discoveries, they didn't just make them up, you know, and they aren't unqualified. Yet, you know, I've heard people just say, oh, well, you know, I heard from so-and-so that, you know, it's not going to be good for me, so I'm going to pass. You know, I find that, like, really disturbing because that was something that I hadn't really been aware of until really COVID. You know, I mean, I knew it seemed like people that were anti-vaccine were like far out in left field. They weren't really taken seriously. But then suddenly they were, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, and, you know, there's a... Science is messy and imperfect, right? And it's constantly evolving. And I think to understand that and then to trust the experts that have dedicated their lives to studying any scientific pursuit, but, you know, medicine and vaccines in particular, like, these people want to help. They want to keep people safe. And their discoveries have saved lives. Are they perfect? No. But they certainly are better than having these diseases running wild in our schools.
Well, you know, on that note, you know, I want to thank you, North Saunders, for making time for us today. And please tell my listeners how they can learn more about Safe Communities, Safe Community Coalition, and volunteer or help with this important issue, because it seems like it just got really more important.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, and I think folks can get involved. They can go to our website, and that's www.safecommunitiescoalition.org. There's a petition on that that site where they can contact their senators to oppose RFK's confirmation for Secretary of HHS. There's also a way to get on our email list. I think the more important thing is to build relationships with your elected officials so that you can become a trusted messenger to let them know that you care about public health, that you care about keeping your kids and your family safe from vaccine preventable diseases. And so get to know your lawmakers and make sure that they can come to you as a trusted member of the community. And so get involved would be my call to action.
All righty. Well, thank you again, North Saunders, and you have a great day.
Thank you. Take care.
Great.
Not all local law enforcement is on board with the plan for mass deportations. President-elect Donald Trump's advisors have been hoping county sheriffs and border states will assist with the incoming administration's mass deportation campaign. But several sheriffs are already publicly promising not to lift a finger. According to a report in Wired magazine this week, Trump's top immigration advisors like Tom Homan and Stephen Miller have been having conversations with several far-right sheriffs who have expressed an interest in helping Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to remove immigrants from the United States. But that effort is unlikely to pick up traction, both for legal reasons and because other sheriffs have said they already have their hands full and don't want to take on more work. Currently, ICE's 286 program allows for state and local law enforcement to collaborate with ICE in its efforts to protect the homeland through the arrest and removal of non-citizens. However, this does not include sheriffs themselves rounding up and detaining undocumented immigrants. Additionally, no federal funding has been appropriated to any sheriff's office that help ICE, meaning just 125 out of 3,081 sheriff's offices in the U.S. have signed up. In Yuma County, Arizona Sheriff Leon Wilmont told Wired that the Supreme Court has already established that enforcing immigration law is outside the jurisdiction of local police departments and sheriff's offices. "That's not our realm of responsibility," Wilmont said. "If we wanted to do immigration law, we would go work for the Border Patrol." The push for sheriffs to assist the incoming administration has been led by retired Sheriff Tom Mack, who is the head of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. Mack told Wired he's been exchanging voice and text messages with Homan about getting more sheriffs involved with deportations. Homan has previously promised to build the biggest deportation force the country has ever seen. But Wilmont said no one listens to Mack, that he hasn't been a sheriff in a long time, and that he pushes his own agenda. Santa Cruz County Sheriff David Hathaway, who is a Democrat, told Wired that he wasn't invited to an event Homan hosted in his state last month, even though Hathaway's jurisdiction includes some of the nation's biggest ports of entry. He added that he would refuse any calls to help the Trump administration deport immigrants, as it would hurt his standing in the county. "I'm not going to cooperate because 95% of the residents of the town where I live, where my county is, are Hispanic," Hathaway said. "I'm not going to go checking the documents of practically every single person in my county to determine their immigration status, because that would create distrust between law enforcement and all the people in my community." The sheriff's bucking calls to assist with mass deportations even include some of Trump's biggest supporters in the law enforcement community. Livingston County, Michigan Sheriff Mike Murphy, who hosted a pro-Trump rally in a building owned by the sheriff's office, told the outlet that he isn't interested in using county resources to help with federal immigration law enforcement. "I still have a county to do police work in," Murphy said. "Just because the president says, hey, go out there and round them up, that's not all of a sudden going to move to the top of my priority list. Somebody's house is getting broken into. That's my priority. If somebody's involved in an injury crash and they're laying on the side of the road, that's my priority. I've got cases that are open." Other border state sheriffs who have come out against calls to help the Trump administration round up migrants include Valverde County, Texas Sheriff Joe Frank Martinez, and Brewster County and Texas Sheriff Ronnie Dodson. According to Dodson, the incoming Trump administration giving sheriffs the authority to jail migrants could break county law enforcement. "I'm not going to let the government tell me how to do my job. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to co-host Steve Norris, and thanks to North Saunders, Executive Director of Safe Communities Coalition, for joining us today. And all kidding aside,